that in that particular instance, we need to give you some examples. Examples of synthetic agents. On that list, you should recognize specifically isoniazid, abbreviated INH. As you will see, isoniazid interferes with the making of mycolic acid, so therefore it's only affected in one genera, which is what? Mycobacteria. So it works in mycobacterium tuberculosis, or mycobacterium leprae, and so on. It only works on that one. As you also learn later, it has serious side effects. You've got liver problems and all that sort of non-stuff. It is not taken lightly when it is taken. Sulfonamides, you can recognize as a synthetic or chemotherapeutic agent. Malvixic acid, also known as quinones, synthetic agent. Trimethoprim as a synthetic agent. You should recognize those specifically as synthetic agents. Then we talked about the fact that spectrum of action, we have narrow spectrum, broad spectrum, and limited spectrum. And of course, the obvious one we've already talked about, that is most antimicrobials work against bacteria because they're prokaryotes and they're eukaryotes, which are someplace deep in the memory core by now. Only a few compounds are antifungal because we're eukaryotic and they're eukaryotic. And very few are antiviral because there's only slight differences between a virally infected cell and a non-virally infected cell. Transcriptase here or there, something like that. But you should recognize there are antiviral drugs, of course. Then narrow spectrum, broad spectrum, limited spectrum. That's pretty forward there. Then we talked about that we can have bactericidal or bacteriostatic effects. Bacteriostatic basically stop the organism from growing. That's what protein synthesis inhibitor would. The DNA and RNA synthesis inhibitor sort of starve the cell, so to speak. Whereas bactericidal kill the cell. And you might think that something bactericidal would be always preferential, but not necessarily so. Well, if we have a gram-negative organism in the bloodstream, it's already releasing endotoxin to significantly increase the rate of increase the release of endotoxin. It can't be a good thing. Also depends on the patient's status, their own immune status. The patient is an otherwise healthy person, then maybe a bacteriostatic, which requires more involvement of the host immune response, might be okay. On the other hand, if we have a severely immunocompromised patient, whose own immune system isn't working that well, then we start looking more to something that would be bactericidal, because that obviously would help the patient out quicker, because their own immune system might have difficulty handling the burden. So we use these category of drugs, but we don't just sort of throw them on the wall and see what sticks. There are combinations, and there are reasons for picking one drug over another. Of course, combinations can be a problem. The bactericidal and the bacteriostatic together could be a problem. If the bactericidal agent, such as a penicillin-type compound, requires the growth of the organism, and then we use the bacteriostatic to stop it from growing, you can see that that might be a problem. But that's just the tip of the iceberg of so-called drug-to-drug interaction. In fact, drug-to-drug interaction will be a major part of what you do to supplement the activity of the overall medical team. You will have more understanding of drug-to-drug interaction than most physicians, and therefore that can be an important adjunct. Your patients take not only to like multiple, they're not only taking the drugs for a particular problem, but they may be on maintenance drugs for other problems, and they may have other acute problems at the same time. And so it's a combination of drugs that do the problem. And as you know, some people take drugs just for the side effects of other drugs that they're taking. So it can be a downward spiral of drug intake. Okay, we notice that something like penicillin still requires something other than penicillin to result in the death of the target cell. In other words, the it's an osmotic event. And that penicillin, if it can grow the organism in an osmotically balanced solution, doesn't kill it. Okay? It just sets it up to be killed by the normal osmotic conditions inside the body. We talk about spheroplasts and protoplasts and that sort of stuff. It's a laboratory finding. Of course, some of the fundamental principles, selective toxicity, just take a body plate in the patient, that should be a good idea. And then we talk about cell wall synthesis inhibitors. Cell wall synthesis inhibitors. And we mentioned the penicillin, and notice it's plural. You might not have seen the fact that it's plural, but it's plural, penicillin. And we talked last time about penicillin, the natural compound used by the mold, is not stable under acid conditions, so we have to modify that. So we can take it orally. And then we wanted a drug that was a broad spectrum agent, so we developed then ampicillin by modifying the R group, keeping the beta-lactam membrane structure intact. Then the organisms developed a penicillinase, which is a specific kind of beta-lactamase, that will attack both penicillin and ampicillin. Notice that there's not an ampicillinase, right? There's a penicillinase that attacks both. So we asked a chemist to modify the compound penicillin to come up with something that was not affected by penicillinase. And methicillin was created. Of course, the organism responded by producing a different beta-lactamase, which is methicillinase. And of course, methicillinase has the other added problem, and it's a narrow spectrum again. So what we really wanted was a broad spectrum penicillinase, methicillinase conditioned compound. Could not make the change. By making a change in one part of the molecule, we couldn't make a change in the other molecule. As a result, we could not develop a semi-synthetic derivative of penicillin that was both broad spectrum and resistant to those two beta-lactamases. However, we were lucky because another mold, cephalosporin, another compound, cephalosporin, so we have another mold producing another compound, and this a compound still has some trade names like Keflex and Keflin associated with it, but it's a broad spectrum cell wall synthesis inhibitor. It is resistant to the intact effects of methicillinase and penicillinase. But it does have a beta-lactam ring, and of course we select for resistance on the basis of what? Cephalosporinase, which is yet another beta-lactamase. And so we begin to see the problem. So we have cephalosporin families, because we can make multiple alterations of the structure. We call them generations because we got tired of naming everything all the time. We have now 6 or 7 generations of cephalosporin, but we do not use them all because we know if we use it, we lose it. And so we keep them in reserve. So a strategy to allow for the continual ability to treat patients is to not use the drugs until nothing else works, rather than using the most recent version of something all the time. We wait until the earlier version fails. We can do this by antimicrobial susceptibility testing. Well, antimicrobial susceptibility testing is bringing the organism and the antimicrobial together in some format in the laboratory setting. Prior to this, we would simply put the patient on the drug, and if it didn't work for that patient, after we went for, say, 10 days, if the cell wall synthesis inhibitor. After 10 days, if it didn't work, then we gave you something else. And after 10 days, if it didn't work and you were still alive, then we gave you something else, and so on. Obviously a problem there. You might not make it through this process of finding out what works. So two fellows, Kirby and Bauer, developed the Kirby-Bauer antimicrobial susceptibility test. And they simply developed this series of standards in which we have a set concentration of the microorganism exposed to a set concentration of the antimicrobial on an auger plate. So you streak the plate in what's called a lawn streak, so you completely cover the organism, completely cover the auger of the plate with a set dilution of the organism. You then add little filter paper discs impregnated with a particular compound. And you can do 8 or 10 or 20 on a plate, depending on how big the plate is. And then as the organism tries to grow from the auger up, and the disc is now diffusing out the concentration of the drug, they come together. The further it diffuses away from the concentration of the disc, the more dilute it is. Therefore, the larger the zone of inhibition, the more susceptible the organism is. Okay, so the further it dilutes, the further it moves out, the more diluted it is at the wavefront. And as a result, then, the more susceptible the organism is. And that led to expressions such as sensitive, intermediate, or resistant by the diameter of the zone of inhibition. So each drug had a particular standard, so many millimeters, 15 millimeters, and certain drugs, such and such, and so on and so on. So we can determine sensitive, intermediate, or resistant to SIRR. Now, we didn't know the exact concentration that worked. We had this relative sense of what worked. The bigger the zone, the more susceptible. This was followed up by a second procedure developed, which is minimum inhibitory concentration, or MIC. The minimum inhibitory concentration is the least amount of drug which inhibits the growth of the organism. Minimum inhibitory concentration, or MIC. In this setting, we take the drug and we test it against the organism in a series of tubes, or more likely, little microtiter wells with a little plastic dish about this big. It's got 12 by 18 rows, 12 by 8. So we have 96 different little wells. Each one holds about 3/10 of a milliliter or 300 lambda fluid. And so we put a little bit of organism and a little bit of the drug. So we have maybe 5 concentrations, or various ways of doing it, but let's say 5 concentrations of the drug. We add a standard amount of bug to each one. And then we look to see what grows. And the least amount of drug, minimum, that inhibits the growth of the organism can be determined. Now this is a much more precise kind of situation. So if you're getting the information in the Costa County Hospital, it might be an SIRR, but if you were at a U of M hospital, it might be a minimum inhibitory concentration. Both of these are usually done by organism, and the data is collected from individual patients and pooled to the doctor's reference. Okay? And so the doctor who's working in more than one hospital, or more likely a doctor on different floors of the same hospital, will know that isolates from this hospital or this floor, the cancer floor versus the emergency room entrance, these are the resistant patterns of Klebsiella pneumoniae, or Streptococcus pneumoniae, or Haemophilus influenzae. Now, obviously, nosocomial agents, that is, hospital-acquired agents, are more likely to be resistant as opposed to community-acquired agents, which are coming in from the hospital from the front door, from the street. And so we don't simply say all Klebsiella pneumoniae can be treated with X. No, it doesn't work that way. Okay. But we can get a good idea of what might be effective in a patient without doing the testing. That is, we gather the data by month, or 6 weeks, or 2 weeks, or 6 months, however they do it in the hospital. And you'll gather that information in full, usually posted in the doctor's lounge or someplace, so the doctor then knows, I have an E. coli infection from someone who is walking from the street. These are my drugs that might be likely to work. Okay. Whereas if I have an E. coli infection from a patient with a catheter who's on the cancer floor, these are the ones that might work. So this gives us a little better guess. Now it's all part are the so-called drug of choice, or DOC. We have to take into other factors besides what works on the organism. We have patient factors, such as the age of the patient, and the function of their bodily parts, such as kidney and liver and so on. Other drugs the patient may be on, so we avoid drug-to-drug interactions. All of those are other considerations, but it begins with what works on the drug. So we have minimum inhibitory concentration, and the older one is the pirbidol, the SIRI, and either one are effective to a certain point. The SIR in some hospitals, the minimum inhibitory concentration, the MIC in some hospitals, is actually broken down to the body site. So it tells us Klebsiella pneumoniae causing a urinary tract infection, or E. coli causing a urinary tract infection, or E. coli in a bloodstream infection. They may have different resistant patterns. So there's a lot of background information. So what we're using is the recent admits, the recent use of LAIs, the recent testing that we've done in that particular setting, a hospital or maybe a subject of a hospital like a cancer ward, and we are extrapolating to what might work today. And of course, if that doesn't work, then we have to do testing, and then that goes into the bank of data. So we need to know what works. Now, why is it that penicillin doesn't work? Well, we know that penicillin may be a radioactive base, could be a resistance. So one mechanism of resistance is develop an enzyme that attacks the drug. I'm not going to give you every drug and every mechanism, but I want to introduce you to possibilities. Another mechanism relative to resistance to penicillin is the production of penicillin binding protein. So some organisms secrete compounds that bind the penicillin and prevent penicillin from penetrating the cell wall. So the penicillin binding protein is another approach. Okay, so we have penicillins and cephalosporins. We'll sort of generalize about those two. On our list now, we also have bacitracin, cycloserine, and vancomycin. They work not at the level of the assembly of the murine layer and cross-linkings and so on, but they work internally to disrupt the making of the linear polymer. And of course, you probably have heard of like methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, MRSA, okay? And typically use something like vancomycin. Or you might have heard, you'll hear more later, of the rehab nursing home problem of a diarrheal problem caused by Clostridium difficile, or C. diff. Vancomycin is our savior in those two settings. A lot of drugs don't work. Vancomycin is still working. So what does that tell us about this use of vancomycin? Do you think the use of vancomycin is on the increase or decrease? If it's a drug that works, we use it more often. And what does that mean in the future? It might not work at all. Okay. So when we have such cases such as methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, the size of resistance to methicillin, we'll see this resistance to other things. The vancomycin still works, but we have problems with it, potentially, as we would develop resistance to it. And of course, once the organisms are developing resistance to it, because we're using it, we're going to select the resistance, and it turns from being a very good drug to being a useless drug in a matter of a year or two sometimes. So it's working now, and that's great. So if you have one of these problems, we have a way of saving you. Okay. As an aside, something like vancomycin, however, if you're a drug company, and you know that this is what something you've got to have, because if you have one of these diseases that's going to do the worst, what do you think? You're going to give it away? Well, maybe charge the least possible? Or might we charge $500 a pill? So it's a very expensive treatment of vancomycin. So anyway, we have other compounds that interfere with cell wall synthesis. So you need to understand, as we go through each of these categories, What is the mechanism of selective toxicity? And it's obvious here, humans don't have cell wall. Okay. So we've got that one down there. Humans don't have cell wall, so that's why it's selectively toxic. And some examples, well, we just gave you several penicillins, the idea of multiple generations of cephalosporins, we have acetracin, cycloserine, and vancomycin, all examples. And then we gave mechanisms of organisms developing resistance. And we said, we talked about the beta-lactam ring and the targets in both penicillin and cephalosporin. Notice I'm not giving you mechanisms of resistance with acetracin and so on. I'm just trying to give you, to put the first code down and give you a sense of these things. Protein synthesis inhibitors. Here it's simplistically put, it basically says different sizes, right? 70S and 80S. What is 70S and 80S? What does that mean? What's an S? We have on the far right, we have chlorampheniphal, azithromycin, and they are on our list over here, and phenytoin and azithromycin. We also have, actually there's a couple of esters, spectinomycin and streptomycin, those are two esters, canomycin, neomycin, gentamicin, amplicacin, and there are two T's. Two T's. And the T's are tobramycin and tetracycline. So two S's and two T's, and they're on the list. Let's take a look at these. You should recognize all nine of these.
Stem cell, the mother of all the cells. And this is an ongoing replacement, so not
only do these stem cells involve with the process of in utero creating these cells initially, but they're also part of the ongoing replacement. And you're making them right now, as you should in the chair, right? They have different half-lives. When you make polymorph inhibitor cells, the PMNs, the ones you made last night at 3 o'clock in the morning are protecting you right now as you put a pimple on your nose or something. Okay? They're phagocytic cells. The ones you're making right now will protect you this afternoon and so on. So you need to constantly make them. They have a half-life in hours. So if you take this drug, chlorpheniclone, and it has the adverse effect of destroying your stem cells in your bone marrow, then the first of all the cells in your bloodstream that we'll notice a problem with will be your polymorph inhibitor cells. And within a day or so, we'll see a neutropenia. Penia means drop in number. Neutro meaning a drop in number of neutrophils. So we think of that not only because the patient now loses some polymorph inhibitor cells and has impaired phagocytosis and all that sort of good stuff, but we know that that's a sentinel cell, the canary in the mine shaft kind of thing. And the canary is very, very sensitive to carbon monoxide, and then the canary would build up in olden times before they had meters. If the canary died in the coal mine shaft, then it's time to get out because the carbon monoxide levels are building up. So the canary was more sensitive than humans, and so the canary would die. Well, here we have that same canary idea, that sentinel cell, that if we know that the patient is experiencing neutropenia following treatment with chlorpheniclone, we also know that the rest of the cells of their bloodstreams can be adversely affected. And if we don't take the patient off of that, we can develop something called aplastic anemia. Aplastic meaning without cells, anemia in the bloodstream. No cells in the bloodstream, this cannot be a good thing. Right? It's a fatal event. And the only thing we can do to rescue the patient then at that point is to give them a bone marrow transplant. Good morning. How are you doing? Was it a good game last night? Was it good reading? What? Not only couldn't hear you, but he's sleeping in the back. He's reading. I'm sorry. Good morning. So we have chlorpheniclone, as a significant agent there that we can use, but we have some serious side effects of that. Okay? And obviously, we can kill the patient. Now, it's not a common problem, but it is a problem we have to be aware of. Erythromycin. Erythromycin is a really interesting structure. We have that organic chemistry for this one. Classifies some macrolides that are into that. You're not going to be heavily into that as a test, but it might be something you might find helpful or not. And here we have this macrolide ring. We see a structure like this, we say, wow, this is a new structure. And we have a particular structure that has to be there, just like we saw with the beta-lactam ring. So this is the erythromycin. But look at all that stuff that we can change. So we got lots of different varieties, which gives us the possibility of developing derivatives of the natural occurring compound, just like we did with penicillin. So what we're trying to do is set down some basic trends and basic ideas. So we see a complicated structure like that, and we have possibilities of substitutions, and we make different kinds of compounds. And that can be good, because the organism may then, its useful life, because we can develop semi-synthetic derivatives, the useful life of the drug can be extended as the organism develops resistance to one form, we can make another form. Or if we want to modify the drug in terms of its rate in which it's absorbed by the patient and all that kind of stuff. So compounding kind of changes can be done. Erythromycin. Erythromycin has another claim to fame. Erythromycin is the typical drug of choice for a patient that's allergic to penicillin. 7 people here. So who's allergic to penicillin? 1, 2, 3. 3 only. Okay, 4. Well, chances are who's not here, who's in the class, is allergic to penicillin. I gave a lecture to 160 some people once and asked if they were only 15. And I said, well, there should be one more. And a guy walks in late, and I said, oh, you're allergic to penicillin. He goes, how do you know? So it's about that 10% figure, okay? Now, when you're allergic to penicillin, you can be allergic to many aspects of penicillin. So let's show them all here. So penicillin molecule. Remember, this is the beta-lactam ring, and these are all the R groups. You've got ampicillin and methicillin and all that kind of stuff, right? Well, you could be allergic to a particular R group. That is, you could be allergic to methicillin, but not allergic to ampicillin. Okay. Or you could be allergic to the beta-lactam ring, in which you're allergic to methicillin, ampicillin, homocephalosporins, penicillin, everything. Now, there is a way of finding out, that is, we could, if you say you're allergic to penicillin, and so, well, maybe you're not allergic to ampicillin. So let's give you ampicillin. And the problem with that particular experimental design is the patient could die, and that would be, oh, now we know you're allergic to that one too, so that's not a good way of doing it. So we do have a test, a lab test, called the radioallosorbin. RASP. Radioallosorbin test, or RASP. And we'll talk about RASP a little later and we'll show you how it works and so on to get into the immune system. But that will allow us to know very specifically what you're allergic to. Are you allergic to the R group, and therefore you're only allergic to methicillin but nothing else? Or are you allergic to the beta-lactam ring, in which you can't get the penicillin, or the semi-synthetic derivatives, or cephalosporins? Well, we need to know that. But until we know that for sure by doing an in vitro test, we take you out of that category completely. The test runs between $500 and $800. So for most practical purposes, it's just easier to give you a rithromycin. So rithromycin is the usual drug of choice if you have a history of being allergic to a penicillin, meaning a compound that has the beta-lactam ring. So in a generic sense, a penicillin, because it means also the cephalosporins. Because they all the penicillin and all the cephalosporins have the beta-lactam ring. So that was a claim to fame for rithromycin. Now that doesn't mean it's going to work all the time. It might not work on the organism, or the person may be allergic to erythromycin, it's a starting point, but not necessarily an ending point. Streptomycin. The organism develops a resistance by having an altered ribosomal protein. Well, that's a new way of doing it. And so the organism has a normal protein, and when we separate the proteins on a electroplating span there, you know what else we're doing, separating protein. So we basically take the tetraribosome, mix it in with the detergent, so we break it up into subunits, and we separate it in an electric field, and we can count the protein. And as it turns out, it's the 10th one, so it's called P10. And so they have the altered P10 protein, the normal P10 protein, streptomycin will bind to it and interfere with protein synthesis for the bacteria, but with an altered ribosomal P10 protein, the organism is resistant. So here's another mechanism of resistance. They're not producing an enzyme, they're not pumping it out, so they have an altered target for the organism. The antibiotic can't bind the organism's ribosome. So that's sort of interesting. And streptomycin has an interesting side effect. Streptomycin can cause cranial nerve damage, particularly cranial nerves associated with hearing. And so people will have a ringing in their ear. And that ringing in the ear is a sign of first work when you're not working properly. You often get sort of static into the nerves and then electrical current. Sometimes when you have nerve damage in an arm or a leg, you get a numbness, but you also may get a sense of vibration, a tingling, and all that kind of stuff. All those are signs of nerve damage of some sort. And in this case, we're having this ringing in the ear, which is a sign of damage being done. And so the patient then is cautioned, not in fine print, but in direct, let's talk about this patient counseling. If you develop any kind of ringing in your ear, stop taking the medication and call us back. Okay? Don't answer the phone. But, the idea is that you want the patient needs to know that some symptoms, some things that can occur, are important for them to report back so you can take them off the medication. Obviously, a patient that already has cranial nerve damage, if this is something that may not be worth the risk to find out if this is going to make it worse. So that means it might be a drug that might work on the bug, but won't work on the patient. The next cluster of drugs, kanamycin, gentamicin, streptomycin, tocilizumab, and amphotericins, the next cluster of drugs, are generally used as a second or third line drug. That is to say, we don't generally use these unless the earlier ones don't work. Again, this is a principle of putting them on reserve so that we have to use them later. Now, for some of these drugs, later is becoming more and more now. In particular, kanamycin and gentamicin are moving up into more common use. We're still holding back streptomycin, tobramycin, and amphotericin, but we will see any of these five drugs more commonly used on a cancer floor. Okay? Because these patients have when you see some of the cancer patients that have had cancer for a number of years, their file is 5 inches thick. They have been in the hospital repeatedly. If they are immunocompromised, as if it's affected the cancer, they have leukemia or something like that, or AIDS, those patients that are immunocompromised have increased risk for rectal infections. The fact that they have another problem with their body and they're into the hospital for treatment, and they are immunocompromised, increase the likelihood of them coming down with a nosocomial infection. Nosocomial infecting agents are more difficult to treat because it requires more resistance, more R factors. And so we end up using these drugs until they don't work. They won't go into the nerve. So membrane disruptors. Cell membrane disruptors. These compounds work on the basis of difference between prokaryotic and eukaryotic cell membranes. There are a lot of things in common between these membranes, and there are some problems because of that. We also have cell membrane disruptors that are used to treat fungal infections. So now we have fungal agents, which are eukaryotic cells, and their membranes are even more like human cells because they're also eukaryotic cell membranes. So let's take a look at some of these. Just to give you two out of this list. Polymyxin B, which is used for bacterial infections, and amphotericin B, which is an antifungal. So we'll give you two of this four, number one and number four on that list. Of those, polymyxin B is a little easier to tolerate. However, the amphotericin B is not easily tolerated. Amphotericin B interferes with ergosterol. And ergosterol is the equivalent of cholesterol in our membranes. The fungal organism's ergosterol is the equivalent of the human cell's cholesterol. structurally similar enough that the drug binds to both. It has a greater binding affinity for ergosterol, and to use it again, fungal infection, but it also has some severe effects on our body. As a result, the membranes of the kidney are most exposed to the highest concentrations of the drug, and therefore this can result in kidney failure. So we don't like to use antifungal drugs. We don't like to use amphotericin B. And when we use it with great caution and monitoring of the patient's kidney function in this case. You can destroy the patient's kidney to the point where it's no longer functional, and they would have to have a kidney transplant or die, or dialysis or whatever. So this is not a good outcome. In general, fungal infections, if they are superficial infections, we can use some drugs as long as they do not get into the bloodstream. So antifungal drugs that are used to treat superficial fungal infections on the skin, ringworm, for example, or athlete's foot, for example. Those fungal infections on the skin, we can be, you know, a little more effective in treating them. If we have a systemic fungal infection, this usually is associated with an immunocompromised patient. So we have a patient that already has a problem with their immune system. Now we have infections to the brain, or lungs, or bloodstream with a fungal agent. This is a very serious situation. The patient could die of the fungal infection. In those settings, then we are up against the wall. We will use what we can to try to save the patient. But we have to be careful as we do that, that in the process we don't hasten the patient's death. So it's really difficult business with antifungal. So when you get to that section of the classes that will be upcoming, pay careful attention as to what can be used and for how long. Like amphotericin B, we will use it for a few weeks, but we will not use it until the patient's completely recovered because it has long-term effects, potentially destroying the kidney. The nurses sometimes call it amphoterapy because of the effect on the kidney. RNA or DNA synthesis inhibitors. Selectively toxic because of different enzymes. That's one. So the transcriptases are different. So we're protein synthesis inhibitors, we're inhibiting translational events. Write that down, we can put the test on. Translational events, because it builds protein synthesis. And now we're talking about transcriptional events. And we have about how much people who do this thing. And so we have those compounds that interfere with the enzymes, and those enzymes will be transcriptases in the case of RNA or DNA synthesis inhibitor. But there's also, besides different enzymes, you could also have the inability to get into human cells, or with the DNA synthesis inhibitor, the inability to get into the genome, to the nuclear membrane of the human cell. Because, of course, the bacterial cell is the nuclear membrane has the genetic information, the genomic information right there in the cytoplasm, undetected everywhere. We have clonomes, and we mentioned maldexic acid as an example of a clonome. These are DNA synthesis inhibitors, and they interfere with an enzyme necessary to unravel the DNA and make a copy of the DNA. So it's a DNA synthesis inhibitor because it blocks an enzyme called the gyrase. So DNA gyrase is the enzyme that swivels, unconnects the strands of DNA so you can make a copy. You can't copy this when they're tightly together. So you unhinge that twist. The DNA gyrase is necessary for that DNA copy to be made, and that interferes with that. The second one I'm giving you should be aware of is the second one, that is rifampin, which is an RNA synthesis inhibitor. And that allows us to explore yet another interesting complication of the use of drugs. drug-to-drug interactions we've talked about, the interaction between, let's say, bactericidal and bacteriostatic drugs, and that was a classic example. Here we have a different kind of interaction. Rifampin alters metabolism in the liver. This altered metabolism accelerates the breakdown of other compounds. One of those other compounds is a common compound that are used in certain birth control preparations. So a woman given rifampin, who's also on a birth control preparation, may have an interesting side effect called pregnancy. So these are the kinds of things you have to be aware of, and they're not necessarily, oh, well, that makes sense. No, it's sort of an unwanted and unthought of possibility. But it does tell us that the drugs have an impact on other organs. Okay? We tend to, okay, what does the drug do? Well, this drug interferes with RNA synthesis. That's it, boom. But what does it do when it gets in the body? There's all kinds of other things. And while it's doing those other things, those may not be one thing that you want done in your body at the time. That's why we have all manners of interactions between the drugs that we give the patient, maybe a diet that they put themselves on. Okay? They find the greatest, latest new diet is to drink beet juice. And they drink 2 gallons of beet juice every day. Or maybe it's carrot juice. And they drink 3 gallons of carrot. They get a juicer and they drink 3 gallons of carrot juice a day. And when they drink all the carrots, it still turns a little yellow. They can drink carrots for the reason. But all these different kinds of diets that the patient may be on, different foods from different cultures, not to mention this genomic effect that if different genes, okay, the genes, of course, are inherited, and some of them are inherited within a defined group of individuals, okay? So we might find Eastern Mediterranean have a certain kind of problem, because they have a certain gene that gives them a different enzyme that this drug doesn't work with. We might find a black population or a Scandinavian population or an Irish population or whatever it might be. Okay? So we need to know as much as we can about the patient. We mentioned the idea of the human genome and so on. The genomics, the use of understanding of a person's genetic information in making the drug of choice is something that's moving down the line. Now, it's not here yet, but it is coming. We're already picking out certain kinds of things already. The only problem we have is we don't have a profile on everybody yet. But that will be coming. When the price gets down to $500, it'll be just sort of name, address, and genome. Okay? And we'll then put that into the system, and we'll just say, oh, well, because of these genomics, we're not going to give you X drug. And what we're looking at are, you know, effects on your liver and whatever else it might be. So some of these strange interactions, like the formin-fentanyl interactions, like the aplastic anemia, those kind of things you may be able to pick out ahead of time. Competitive inhibitors. Bacterial cell for biosynthetic purposes in growing carbon chains. We, on the other hand, must have a dietary intake of folic acid, or the tetrahydrofolic folic acid. We need to eat it. It has to be in our diet. It has to get into our bloodstream. We can't make it. So drugs that interfere with the making of it have no effect on us. Hence the basis of selective toxicity. Interfering with a pathway that bugs have that we don't have. So let's take perinolenolic acid in a series of steps to down the dihydro and tetrahydrofolic acid. Notice that we have a couple of blocks. We can interfere with folic acid metabolism by two different mechanisms. Sulfa drugs, that's a plural, sulfonamide, which is a series of sulfa drugs, sulfonylamide. So sulfa drugs, also known as sulfonylamide. The sulfonylamide, the sulfa drugs, interfere with the creation of dihydrofolic acid. Trimethoprim, on the other hand, interferes with the conversion of dihydrofolic acid to tetrahydrofolic acid. And here's a great example of the combination therapy. Combination therapy is when we use more than one drug at the same time, either interfering or providing protection or whatever the purpose of that drug is, together. In this case, they're interfering with the same pathway. So this is a combination therapy situation. Combination therapy for these two competitive inhibitors. Now the reason why we do that is that we can use lower amounts of each of the drugs if we use it in combination than if we would use them together, or use them individually. Okay? So we actually compound the drug together. The patient takes them both at the same time in the same drug. Now, if you think about this, we have a competitive situation. So the enzyme that's converting perinolenolic acid to dihydrofolic acid gets diverted by this roadblock. And let's say a certain concentration, so if we looked at it, when we went from, say, 2, maybe kilograms, whatever, units are not important, it's a relative situation. We went from 2 milligrams to 5 milligrams. We went from maybe 10% killing up to 70% killing. But then we went from 5 to 15, we only increased by 10. In other words, you don't often get a straight line curve. More is always equally better. Doubling gives you double killing, or whatever. So we have a sigmoidal-shaped curve. So that means to get that last 10%, we had to have a 300% increase in the amount of drug, triple the amount of drug. If we use two drugs at lower concentrations, the first one blocks the first step. Let's say it allows, it kills 70%. That means 30% of the molecules go forward. Well, if the next one kills 70 or 90%, now we've only got 70 to 90% of the 30 that went through. And so we end up with a much higher effective killing. Or in this case, the effective status, which is a much higher effect of the drug. So two drugs used in combination at lower concentrations with lower possible side effects are better than one drug used in a high concentration. Combination therapy. And this is so effective this way that it's usually not given individually, but we actually compound the two drugs together in the same pill. Resistance is a property of the organism. Humans can become allergic to a drug, but they don't become resistant to the drug. Lay people may have problems with that, but we should be able to figure that out. So we have organisms are resistant, patients are not resistant. They can be allergic. And they have to be there, just for what we've been saying. Probably never exist an antimicrobial to which some organism cannot become resistant. And remember, once any one organism becomes resistant, it becomes something in the genomics of the microorganism as a group, and through transmission, transduction, conjugation, we have it spreading amongst the group. It's just a matter of time. So the problem persists in more than one organism. And we talked about different mechanisms of resistance, more than ones that are listed there. We talked about tetracycline, we talked about penicillinase, and many others. Let's take a look at what we've got there. So we talked about murine synthesis inhibitors that can show up in the inhibitors. We talked about membrane disruptors, protein synthesis inhibitors, RNA inhibitors. If we look at what's used, okay, so we memorize the top 200 drugs or whatever, we can see that cephalosporins are big on the list. Now this is just one hospital at one point in time. They are not coming to bring down the strain and so on. Just to give you a general sense. Cephalosporins, pretty common in use. Macrolides, that's the rhythmicin. Penicillin, over here, that's 17. Clonones are over here. So we just did simply cephalosporins and penicillins. We got 17 and 37. So there's 54% right there. Macrolides, rhythmicin, again, that's sometimes people are allergic to penicillin. This is a nice little review. It only shows what we're dealing with in terms of protein synthesis inhibitors, RNA, DNA synthesis inhibitors, cell wall synthesis inhibitors, etc. So that's a little bit of a chart. Give you some examples of things that you can know about beta-lactamases and so on. Fenacol, which we talked about, there's a drug act. There's an enzyme attacks on that as well. And so again, it's just a variation of the theme. The theme is the organism produces an enzyme that breaks down substrate in the drug. So you have to memorize the form of fenacol translation, but recognizing that's another thing that happens. You get the previous class and so on, you see things that your number not there. But after just write down the here we have pyrimine of benzoic acid, which is a sulfur drug, and they're trying to enter them. You can see the similarity in the structure. So, pyrimine of benzoic acid sort of looks like this. It's a similarity to the endpoint. And then you see the basic structures that are really stuck under it. Now, mycin, we've got a nice big structure. We like big structures because it gives us opportunities to develop positions in ultimate forms. And you can see that the organism also likes these big structures because there's an enzyme attack, a pseudotransferase attack. So we see that for kanamycin, organisms can develop enzymes that will attack kanamycin. There's a mycin, we've got a macrolide. Tetracycline, wow, we really like this, right? Tetracycline, gorgeous, all kinds of R factors, and we don't need to memorize this, but there are dozens of tetracyclines that we need. And because we have a lot of that we can make substitutions on. So this will be good for you to play with when you get to that course. But you can see where organic chemistry is coming from. So lots of different substitutions, and each one may or may not have an advantage. That advantage is both a microbial, does it work better, but it's also an economic advantage. If the drug works in this new form, which is we develop a new R group, and we put it on, we create a new kind of tetracycline. But if it doesn't work any better than the old, and it's three times as expensive, then you lose the market value. So there's a commercial aspect of this as well. But the more complicated the structure, the more likely we develop R groups and hopefully develop different drugs for resistant organisms. Then we go to resistance, can be genomic or plasmid related. I don't know whether it's on the main chromosome or on a plasmid. Remember that if it's on a plasmid, it could be a self-replicating plasmid or a non-self-replicating plasmid. And remember the mating types of F plus and HFR and F prime, the male cells, the germ cells, as well as the F minus, could all have non-self-replicating plasmid that does not change its main category. And many, many cells have many, many different kinds of non-self-replicating plasmid. And we talked about the possible origin. We talked about the sexduction idea that we may have this non-self-replicating plasmid sort of occurring at the end of this chain to begin with creating the first F plus and then the first HFR and then the first F prime and then we have the first non-self-replicating plasmid. So that's such an event. Also recognize that the number of plasmids inside of an organism influences the amount of the resistant form it can have. So if it has an enzyme that's producing an enzyme that attacks the drug, the more plasmids it has, the more enzyme it produces. One strategy that can be used if the drug does not have significant side effects is simply to increase the amount of the drug to overcome the presence of the enzyme. For example, penicillin, because it works on the making of a cell wall, and we don't have cell walls, penicillin can be given in gram amounts, not milligrams, but gram amounts without side effect to the patient. So if you're not allergic to it, you can take a lot of it. Now, it still may ultimately take the same amount of international units to actually kill the organism, that is, to stop the synthesis of the murine layer. But you may have to sort of sacrifice many, many hundreds of milligrams to be chewed up by the enzyme produced by the organism, so we overwhelm it and eventually get enough into the murine layer to block synthesis, which is sort of a law of mass action. Because we don't have serious side effects, some drugs we can do that way. And the more of these plasmids, whether they're self-replicating or non-self-replicating, that are producing enzymes, the little factories producing the enzyme, the more enzyme being produced, the more plasmid it has, the greater the drug we have to add before we actually get to the effective dose. That is the advantage of the minimum inhibitory concentration. That MIC allows us to know, boy, we can give you a lot more of this drug, and it will be effective. Whereas when you did the Kirby-Bauer, you just had this zone of inhibition. And it was really hard to determine how much that equates to actual amounts in the body. But with the minimum inhibitory concentration, we can actually calculate bloodstream levels necessary to actually be effective in the killing. And we may find that, for example, 10 times or 5 times the normal amount of penicillin is going to be effective in this patient as compared to the vancomycin or some other compound, which is going to be much more expensive, or maybe that other compound needs to be given as an IV, because now we can start playing with the route of delivery. And you take 5 times the concentration of penicillin to take it orally. That's preferable over another drug that also works, but you have to give it IV because you give it orally, it causes diarrhea. Okay? So by wiping out the normal form you got. So give that drug IV, that means the patient has to be, at the very least, in the hospital for a few hours every day, or possibly admitted. So now the cost of that drug totally is several thousand dollars a day because you're now in the hospital setting. Versus penicillin, higher concentration that we can give you, and you can go to Myers. A lot of people in Myers are in drugs. So you keep it. It's going to take a drug. You're not an IV drop, probably, but not long enough, but it's taking drug. So basically, if you're taking a drug orally, it could be less expensive. And cost is a factor, because not only is it a nice thing to do, and it's a good thing for the economy to do, but you'll find patients that when you say, well, this treatment is going to cost you $1,500, they're going to say, I don't think so. They may not tell you that. They just won't do it. They just won't do it. But they do it, they'll do it in a manner that makes it ultimately inefficient. And so cost actually affects the effectiveness of the use of the drug. So these are all things that we can do. Again, because it can be plasmid-related, it can increase in units because there's more and more plasmid dissolving in the region. Maybe we'll overcome that with higher concentrations of drugs. I'll just give you a sense of when kinds of things occur. Staph aureus, common kind of skin infections, boils, and that sort of stuff. And it can cause other kinds of serious infections, wound infections, and so on. But that was one of the early ones we treated. And then we find, so we start finding resistance to treatment in the even before 1950. Other gram-negative organisms develop resistance. And it starts then, and where were these found? These were found in the intestinal tract of people that were treated with the Staph aureus. Shigella and Salmonella, so these are generally non-pathogens. And Shigella organisms, Salmonella organisms, these are organisms that are potentially pathogens, typically are. And where did they get the resistance? Well, they got it when they were in the guts and the organisms that got it, the normal flora organisms that were resistant. And the normal flora organisms were resistant because the patient was treated with it as a skin infection. Okay. So we treat the skin infection. How does the drug know where to go? It goes everywhere. So therefore, it selects for resistance among the normal flora in the gut. Then we have gut pathogens picking it up. Now we have an organism like Pseudomonas. Now, Pseudomonas is really significant problem. Pseudomonas is a significant problem because it has many R factors, and we find it in a hospital setting. There are isolates of Pseudomonas that cannot be treated with antibiotics. Fortunately, not commonly, but it does occur. Pseudomonas is a very efficient organism. It will survive in extremely minimal media. Look at this growth, the step up and step down growth curve. In the life phase and so on. This organism is capable of growing on extremely minimal medium. Okay? I'll give you a sense of what I mean by that. Pseudomonas is able to, has been isolated from the distilled water from a hospital source. So the hospital had a tank on its roof, and it had distilled water in this tank. It was an old tank, and it had gotten a little bit of contamination in it from an algal organism. And since it had been used for a while, the pipes had a little scale, calcium deposit. A little bit of mineral deposits on the inside, plus the presence of small trace amounts of algal organisms, allowed the organism to grow. It doesn't need a whole lot. And it's also found in soils, so it's given contaminated wounds, and it's found in hospitals. It grows in hospitals. It's almost like a normal flora organism in certain hospitals. We can find it in the carpet in the hospital. I know that went to a continuing medical education in Harvard once, and this fellow and I were coming in from Logan Airport at 1:30 in the morning, and we're talking, and he's coming to the same Harvard Med kind of program, I don't know what to do. And he's from West Virginia. He's the intensive care doctor, and he worked with some burn patients. And he lost, I think it was 3 burn patients from a Pseudomonas infection. They were isolated, they went in the same areas. When the first one died, completely cleaned the rooms up. Another one gets it, the third one gets it, they all died. A Pseudomonas infection, bloodstream infection. Where did it come from? The third patient dying before they found that the organism was under the little aluminum foil flap they could lift up to put the straw in for the orange juice. That's where the organism was. We've isolated the organism on the mops in health TV in a hospital. If they don't mix the detergents right, the cleaning solution properly, and it's easy to make a mistake. If they don't label things properly, they take a working solution and they dilute it thinking that it's a stock solution. And just simply over-diluted. And now you've got it in the mop. So not only do you have a problem in the mop, but you're mopping the floor. And so this guy is happily mopping the floor, and he's had Pseudomonas everywhere. Okay. We find Pseudomonas in hospitals that we cannot treat. Not a good problem. Okay. Serious business. So we can see Pseudomonas fix it up. Gonorrhea picks up the resistance. This is gonorrhea. Amorphous in the late 60s, Amorphous Dupri, which is a sexually transmitted disease, tuberculosis developing resistance in the mid 70s, and so on and so on and so on. Cynobacter is another grapple organism. Enterobacter, Enterococcus cutalis, another intestinal tract organism. So we are becoming like the hospitals. That is, hospitals are a source of multiple antibiotic resistant strains because of the use of the antibiotics in the hospital. Well, imagine what's going on in the guts of a patient from age 18 months when you first had your first clot, you had an earache, which we'll learn later probably wasn't, but was treated anyways. Okay. So the first exposure to antibiotics may begin at 18 months. By the time you're 12 to 15, you've had all kinds of antibiotics. And those are not one-time, forget it, never happens again event. They have changed the culture of your gut. They select for resistant organisms. So when you get pathogens, they communicate with one another. Transformation, transduction, conjugation. And now the pathogens matter. And so it goes. So the more we use the drugs in the patient, the more it's difficult to use the drugs in the patient. So the patient is the microcosm of the whole thing. So, and one notice that you don't see the organisms then losing the resistance. Now, there is a theory that if we ban an antibiotic, let's say we ban all the beta-lactamase drugs, all the beta-lactamase drugs, and then the beta-lactamase enzyme would sort of dilute out because we're not enriching the population. That's a theory. So when we get to the year 2040 and drugs aren't working, this was a strategy that might save us. The problem with the strategy is that all you need is it that 1%, 10% of the organisms? So we have 99.9% of the organisms that have lost the resistance, and you just have that little one out there, and you're planning to stop again as soon as we start using it. So we can minimize it by not using it, bring it back, or put it on the container and pull it back. But it's not going to be like it never was before. It's back to the beginning. Here's the percent-resistant fecal strains versus the amount of use. Okay. Well, it's not a perfect straight line, but oh my goodness, it's pretty close. Okay. Gentamicin, we don't use it as much, we don't have as much resistance. Remember, that's one of our drugs that we've got. Tetracycline, we use a lot. It's a lot. So we use this in a ton. Now, canamycin and streptomycin aren't quite as high as you might expect, but they're still in that category. But basically, the more we use something, the greater the percent resistance people strain. These are people walking around with resistant strains in their gut, normal flow. Remember, we have a large population of organisms in our gut, not to mention elsewhere, but just in our gut. You have about 10 trillion cells in your body, and your gut has about 100 trillion bacteria. You have 10 times more organisms in your gut than you have cells in your body. So these are the ones that are being selected. There's over 1,000 different genus and species of organisms in your gut. So lots of someone that give you information for that. Now, how fast can this occur? You see, in a 10-year period of time, we went from not being resistant to having almost 10%. And this was a penicillin resistant gonorrhea, just as an example. If you do this with all different organisms. And this curve, if you look at it, is increasing at an increasing rate. So if you just connect with the dots there, you have this going up back. So it's not a straight line curve. Significantly increasing in those dots. That's what's happening. So it's not the next 10 years going to be like this. Because now we can't use it. We don't use penicillin. We haven't used probably from about 1995 on, we didn't use commonly to treat gonorrhea in the United States. That really didn't work. And then the fungal agents, again, just a few more that we wanted to mention. One, resorbin, it affects DNA synthesis. This is often used on topical treatment, so this might be found against the ringworm or after the foot or something like that. Again, topical use because it may be may produce more side effects than we use it systemically. And here we see that we have a compound that interferes with the making of the ergosterol as well as then binding to it. This is a viral drug. Ignore that page 4 or 5. Basically, the antiviral drug. Cyclovir, used to treat herpes. One of the trends we want to mention here is that some will result in a cure in the traditional sense of when we use an antibiotic for bacteria, and some will not. And the difference is whether or not the virus integrates into the genome of the host cell. If the virus integrates into the patient's genome, you cannot get a cure. You can treat, maybe minimize period of time of symptoms, but you will not eradicate the organism if the organism is in the genome. And the current problem is merely a manifestation of the release of virus copies, but the original is still hidden in the genome. So we have progeny virions released that are causing a living infection someplace. For example, in the case of herpes, this would be like herpes simplex, for example. The herpes virus, for example, herpes simplex. And we have herpes simplex serotype 1, which causes problems at the mucocutaneous junction of your lip and skin. And we have herpes simplex serotype 2, which is a general herpes. More about all this a little later. But herpes virus is a DNA virus that integrates into your genome. So we're not going to get a cure. We're going to treat. Acyclovir interferes with the virus replication, and it decreases somewhat the length of time that you have that lesion and the length of time that you are shedding the virus. The shedding of virus means that you are releasing virus into your environment. is releasing the virus into the environment. It's not that the patient's going to be more infected, but it's infecting the, in a sense, transmitting the virus. With herpes simplex, for example, you are shedding the virus before you get the blister, during the time you have the blister, and for maybe 10 days to 2 weeks after the blister is gone. If we use a drug, such as cyclovir, we decrease the period of time that you're shedding and therefore are spreading it to other people. And we may decrease the time of the blister by a day or so. That's the typical kind of thing. Now, when cyclovir was first developed, it was thought that it would be a great ointment because that would be something you need for people to use. It has an ointment as a salve or something that you put on the patient. It's a very minimal effect. It's not a very effect. So if we want to use it, we typically take it orally. And it's not an inexpensive drug. It's an expensive drug taken daily. Now, for most people, the appearance of the blisters, whether it's type 1 or type 2, is an infrequent event. That is to say, you may be infected. In fact, with this particular virus, the infection rate is pretty much considered to be 100%. Slightly less than 100% are seropositive at age 15. Okay, but we figure that those who are not seropositive are just not producing the antibody we're looking for. So we assume it's universally infected. We figure everybody in the room is infected. But most people have it hidden in the genome and it doesn't express, and they don't have fever blisters or cold sores on any routine basis. So you may have one a year, or one every 3 years, or one every 5 years, or something like that. Relatively rare. Some patients, either because of the interaction of that particular virus, or because they are immunocompromised at the time, can have much more frequent outbreaks, like maybe monthly. Okay. So in those are the patients that have frequent outbreaks are the patients we put on the oral treatment with the cyclovir. Okay. So the person that occasionally has one, they don't use it. Its most effective use is really the patients that are severely immunocompromised who get a bloodstream infection. And in those settings, we give it IV, and it's extremely effective. So an immunocompromised patient with a serious herpes infection, this can lead to encephalitis, blindness, and death. So it's a serious outcome in an immunocompromised patient. But given IV, it's very, very effective. Unfortunately, the organism, when we use it under those settings, usually after about the third year of use in these patients, it no longer becomes effective because the organism develops a different enzyme. It's a thymidine kinase. We'll get more of that later. But it interferes with a thymidine kinase. And what the organism often does is that it adapts to using your thymidine kinase instead of its thymidine kinase, and therefore it doesn't, it's not effective at all. So we select for the resistance of antiviral drugs by using the antiviral drug. It's a no-brainer. It's no different than we use the antibacterial. And as I alluded to earlier, the same thing is true of cancer treatment. We select for the resistant ones and such. Thanks for the genetics. Okay, so cyclovir, we use it for, you can see the listing there, general herpes and so on. Cyclovir is also working with other herpes viruses. This should be varicella, that's an S up there to be made. Varicella virus, which causes chickenpox, and once the virus is integrated into your genome, it can reactivate something called shingles, okay, or zoster. The varicella virus causes chickenpox and zoster, which is the shingles. Shingles is a reoccurrence, again. Both general herpes, the herpes simplex viruses, the oral herpes, the herpes simplex, as well as the varicella viruses, all these are DNA viruses, double-stranded DNA viruses that integrate into our genome, and it has a preferential integration into our nervous system. Okay. And And then when it gets to the cutaneous system, it causes a lytic infection. And we had the different kinds of different sites of the body. So in that particular case, we see the lytic infection of a blister. So the blister you see is the lytic infection site. The actual blister itself is actually a T cell response. So it's sort of an allergic reaction, but more later. But here we have another herpes virus that we use as a site of the And that's used particularly elderly populations. The immune system is a little weak, maybe they're 70 or 80 or whatever. They have chicken pox with a child, they have a reactivation of herpes zoster. Herpes zoster is nothing minor. Okay? Think of that herpes zoster is a potentially serious problem for a couple of reasons. First, it can involve the eye and lead to blindness, brain infections. That's usually in very markedly immunodeficient patients. But for the other patients who are just average immunodeficient for an 80-year-old person, they will have these peripheral nerve endings that are really, really inflamed and a significant pain involved. And it's fairly easy to diagnose. You can even see someone in 3 minutes out of the year. It's nothing at all. Herpes zoster is going to be a rash from one side of the body only. So midpoint to midpoint. And you'll see the little blisters. And the blisters are the end of the nerve endings. In fact, you can almost connect the dots and see which nerves are involved. Okay, so you have one side from the belly button to the back, half the nose, half the face. Okay, so you see that pattern in an older person, the first place you go to your brain is shingles. Okay? And we want to treat it early with something like a cyclosporine to minimize the viral load on the patient, which minimizes the inflammation of the nervous system. Otherwise, what happens is that we can get rid of the infection, which the little blisters eventually get necrotic looking and you get these black scales and so on. It's pretty nasty. But that's sort of the end stage of it. But what can happen, those will eventually fade off for several weeks, maybe a month or 6 weeks. But what will happen is that sometimes these patients will have nerve pain as a result of that that can last for 6 months, a year, or longer. So they can be in significant agony for months. And all we need to do is use a cyclosporine early on in the process, we minimize the viral load, and we get rid of that complication. Otherwise, the patient needs to go on pain therapy as a result of it. Question over here.
Yeah, this might be kind of odd, but what about a breather in terms of you talking about cold sores and fever blisters? What exactly is that?
These cold sores go away in usually 2 to 4 days. Yeah. And when you take various kinds of, and there's an endless list of them, from taking lysine to all kinds of different things, and we do it, they tend to go away in 2 to 4 days. Even a cyclosporine at best maybe minimizes it by 1 day. And we know that one works. So it's really a concern, Marley, it's more likely those patients that have monthly problem as opposed to somebody having an occasional problem. It's expensive and it's not all that effective in terms of reducing the blister. And the shedding time is reduced a little bit, but nothing major. A major use could be the immunocompromised patients, bloodstream infections, systemic infections, encephalitis, eye infections. Those are all serious consequences. So bloodstream infection, good use. The zoster case, good use. The normal blister, not so much. Aggressive ASC inhibitors. We'll talk more about that a little later. That's a reverse transcriptase inhibitor. We also have, for treating HIV infections, we have a cocktail that we'll talk about called TARC, which is a highly reactive antiretroviral treatment. And it's a cocktail. And in that cocktail, we have a reverse transcriptase enzyme, inhibitor drugs. We also have protease inhibitor drugs. The protease inhibitor blocks the release of the virus. We have an envelope virus, and we have this flooding release, and the protease inhibitors block the release of it. So we can interfere with reverse transcriptase with AZT-type compound, but we can also interfere with the release. Okay. Now that gives us an interesting situation because we look into AIDS patients treated with the cocktail. The level of virus in the bloodstream can drop significantly to the point below detectable level. That's good news because it's not spreading within the patient. Not to be confused with cure, because the virus still has its DNA equivalent, and it's an RNA virus, has a DNA equivalent inserted in the genome. All we're doing is sort of slowing up the process by not having it free. Also bear in mind that the easy way in which the virus goes from person to person is inside cells, inside, for example, a macrophage. So it's inside a macrophage, which is one of the cells that's an inflammatory response, an acidic response. So if you have a wound and you're an HIV positive patient, even though your serum level of free virus is extremely low because you're on protease inhibitor, inside your phagocytic cells are all kinds of organisms. And if you have a concomitant infection, that is, you have another infection of some sort, that wound then is teeming with organisms inside the phagocytic cells, and it easily goes from person to person. The way the virus is spread is usually not free virus in the setting, but inside a cell. In the final analysis, when you get AIDS from that bowel, it doesn't make you get a tiny bowel, you got it. So don't confuse decreased infectivity or cure with the lack of free virus. Okay? Because the virus is inserted into the cell, it is found in phagocytic cells like macrophage, and therefore those cells will go up to a wound site and it needs to be infected first. Amantadine. Amantadine is used to treat and prevent influenza A. So we have a prophylaxis, a chemoprophylaxis. This would be good to be used, let's say, in a nursing home and so on. Now, there's some side effects of amantadine, and those are not supposed to be heavy equipment and things of that nature. But in general, it's very effective. It's not commonly used. Oftentimes, it's not commonly used because physicians think that there aren't good antiviral drugs, no matter their education below. But there are specific settings where this is really, really good. One of those settings would be during a flu epidemic in a nursing home or rehab center where we have a lot of elderly population. They're at risk of getting influenza. The bacterial infections that follow will kill them. Okay? So they can die of a viral infection or they can get a secondary bacterial infection which will kill them. Okay? So we can prevent the initial viral infection obviously by immunizing them. But if they're in such a weak state, their immune system may not respond effectively to the immunization. So we can give nursing home people, for example, amantadine. That would be good for the people that have the infection, influenza A, and it would be good to prevent people from getting influenza A because it works as a prophylaxis. Now, there are several drugs that we use for, we'll talk more later, but several drugs that we can use treat influenza. You've heard of Tamiflu and so on. Realize that as we use these, we will then select for resistance. Okay? And the various isolates from around year to year on the seasonal flu, some are more susceptible to Tamiflu than others. So, for example, people stockpiling Tamiflu in case we get the bird flu that wipes out a whole bunch of people. We don't know, one, what that bird secondly, we have no idea whether Tamiflu or any of the others would work. And thirdly, if we mass produce Tamiflu in those things, we will select the resistant isolate. So you hear about the current use in the swine flu concern, H1N1. The swine flu, you hear about the use of Tamiflu, but we say use it in the early stages, use it with certain people, children, and so on. It's not that it won't necessarily be somewhat effective in those other categories, but we're trying to use it when it's most effective and not use it when it will then simply develop more resistance. Okay? So we have to worry about developing resistance with antivirals as well. Okay, we got ACT listed there. We talked about that one. Ribavirin. Ribavirin is used, by the way, amantadine will result in a cure. Amantadine will result in influenza that is not integrated in the genome. So we completely eradicate the organism in the body when we use amantadine, because it does not integrate. That was not the case with HIV, and it's not the case with herpes, and so on. Or CMV for that matter. Here we have ribavirin used in respiratory syncytial virus, RSV. So RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, this can cause, obviously, a respiratory care problem. And it's particularly associated with immunocompromised individuals, which would be children in up to about the age of 5. So infants and children up to about the age of 5 are considered immunocompromised. We also have concerns about transplant patients and AIDS patients and leukemia patients and so on that may develop RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, and we give ribavirin for that. That also results in a cure. RSV does not integrate into the genome. Interferon, listed over here. Interferon is a recombinant product. It's a normal occurring product part of our immune response. So it's a small, low molecular compound. We can make it to become the DNA technology. And we use it to treat a variety of things, in particular, hepatitis B and hepatitis C infection. So hepatitis B and hepatitis C infection are part of the treatment when we use interferon. Unfortunately, in many cases, the chronic active case in particular, and the chronic liver infection of hepatitis C, the virus has already integrated. This will not result in a cure. The integration rate of typical hepatitis B is someplace around 15 to 20%. The integration of hepatitis C approaches 90%. Integration means you got it into the genome and you can't get rid of it. Let's see, and almost here we mentioned protease inhibitors. We already talked about protease inhibitors. Blocking the release. So we have two approaches to HIV. Reverse transcriptase type compound that inhibits that enzyme and release that's going from RNA to DNA. And protease inhibitor, which block the release of the virus. Next time we'll talk about